From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Clayton Christensen gets the big bucks and a lot of satisfaction, he says, from sitting down with companies to think through their challenges. Now he's thinking about your challenges, what it takes to make a successful life. It's not a slick package. He's not a slick guy. A devout family man and an icon of business theory, he's tackled cancer, heart attack, stroke, diabetes, and some of the biggest questions in life. This hour on Point Life Lessons with Clay Christensen. You can join the conversation. Do you have a plan for living that you could articulate? What's in it? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll hear the wise words of advice from award-winning author and young adult fantasy writer Neil Gaiman at his commencement speech at Philadelphia's University of the Arts. But first, joining me from Salt Lake City is Clayton Christensen, professor at Harvard Business School. He's one of the most influential business thinkers today. His book, The Innovator's Dilemma, has been a kind of Bible in the Internet era with its theory of disruptive innovation. A former Rhodes Scholar, a devout Mormon whose faith is clearly at play in his latest work. His new book with co-authors James Allworth and Karen Dillon is How Will You Measure Your Life? Clay Christensen, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you.
Oh, it's great to be back again with you, Tom.
You say that you sat down with old friends at college reunions over the years and the stories tumbled out and you were struck by the fragility of all their plans and early dreams, their vulnerability to all kinds of problems.
Yeah, it's. I never imagined that it would turn out in the way it has with so many of my friends. One of the characteristics of the Harvard Business School is every 5 years, the school invites you to come back. And I've always come back to our reunions. And I remember when I came to the fifth reunion, oh, my goodness, everybody was at the top of its game. Most of my colleagues, most of my friends had married people who were much better looking than they were. And, you know, and their careers were going handsomely. But then as we came back to the 10th and the 15th and 20th, and especially at the 25th, it was really striking to see how many of our friends who we thought would come just never showed up. And when I try to ask through our common friends what's going on, more often than I ever imagined, the answer was, oh, he's in a messy divorce, or he just didn't want to come. His wife married another man, and another guy is raising their children on the other side of the country. And what strikes me as I look upon that carnage is, when we graduated, there wasn't a single one of my classmates who had an explicit strategy to go out and get divorced and raise children who were alienated from them. And yet a shocking number of them implemented a strategy that they never intended to pursue.
And ended up, you write, too many times with personal dissatisfaction in their careers and beyond, family failures, professional struggles, even Clay, criminal behavior.
Yeah. Yeah, one of our colleagues, Jeff Skilling, was the CEO of Enron and was the pilot as it tanked. And I remember when we were in school together, he was a good man. He loved his family. He was a good, honest man. There were 32 of us that got Rhodes scholarships in my year to go off to Oxford. Two of them ended up in jail. And again, they were good people, but something where they just made an incremental decision that at the time seemed to be okay added up to a sequence of decisions that were disastrous.
So here you are looking at this reality of human frailty and failure after such promising starts. You've spent many years talking with companies about how to get their corporate strategies, you know, on target. I'm looking here in the book. I mean, you reach out and look at all kinds of examples from that world and bring them now into the personal world. I mean, how similar is it when you start thinking about personal life strategies against a background of corporate strategies. Do these things mesh? Do the same dynamics work in both spheres, Clay?
Tom, they really do. And it was really my students at the in the MBA program at Harvard that led me in this direction. So a good way to think about the world is that the world is nested. So we have industries inside of economies and corporations inside of industries, business units inside of corporations, teams inside of business units, people inside of teams, and our brains inside of ourselves.
Like a Russian doll there, all that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And I had observed in my research of innovation that the same causal mechanism was at work at the level of an industry, a corporation, a business unit, and a team. And I never really had thought about, does the same fundamental causal mechanism at work in our own minds in a very similar way? And what we decided to do on the last day of my class is to ask the students to come to class prepared to study whether these theories that we developed to understand how corporations compete really are at work at individual lives. And it turns out they are. Now, so for example, General Motors has just been on the brink of insolvency, mm-hmm. Coming now back from bankruptcy. And there's a causal mechanism. That is, Toyota didn't come to America with Lexuses, but rather they came in at the bottom of the market in the 60s with a rusty little subcompact called a Corona. Do you remember those?
Yes, I do.
And then they went from a Corona to Tercel, Corolla, Camry, Avalon, Forerunner, Sequoias, and then a Lexus. And General Motors and Ford would look at Toyota coming at them from the bottom, and they weren't asleep at the switch, but they would look at the profitability of a crummy little subcompact with the profitability of making even bigger SUVs and pickup trucks for even bigger people. And it just didn't make any sense to defend the least profitable part of the business.
Why bother?
That's right. And so never did the senior management and board of General Motors get together and agree, you know, ladies and gentlemen, let's develop a plan to run this corporation off the cliff. They never intended to do it, but that's actually what they did. And the reason was that on an individual basis, what product should we invest in? What product should we not invest in? What product should we advertise? What product should we not advertise? And so on. Mm. Incremental decisions that at the time made consummate sense, mm-hmm. added up to what they didn't want to do.
What's the parallel then in individual lives, Clay, to that big strategic picture?
Yeah. Well, it turns out that we have the very same situation. So just as General Motors had to decide which of all of these products that they're making they should invest in and which they should not invest in our personal lives, we have multiple business units. And so we have our careers, we have our children, we have our spouses, we have our commitment to our churches sometimes, our commitment to our communities. Mm-hmm. And we have to decide which of all of these things will I invest in, invest meaning of our energy and our time and our talents, and which will we put off until tomorrow. And people who have a very high need for achievement, and that includes nearly almost all of us, when we have an extra ounce of energy or 30 minutes of time, we will instinctively invest our resources into whatever activity yields us the most immediate evidence that we've achieved something.
Okay.
And our careers provide that evidence. You know, I finish a sale, I ship a product, I complete a presentation, I finish teaching a course, I get promoted, I get paid. And our careers provide very tangible, immediate evidence of achievement. In contrast, when we spend our time and energy with our children, on a day-to-day basis, they just keep misbehaving. And it's really not for 20 years that you can step back and put your hands on your hips and say, we raised a great young man. Because it pays off only in the long term, we have a tendency in our minds to invest in those things that give us the most immediate evidence of achievement. The reason why corporations have this propensity to invest in the short rather than long term is that they're run by people like you and me.
But everybody knows, it's sort of learned at grandmother's knee, put family first. I mean, we all kind of know that in the back of our minds. You're saying we know it, but we don't actually do it.
You're exactly right, Tom. Nobody would ever say that their plan was to raise a family that was fractionated, and yet that happens because we do things that make in immediate sense.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about simply how to live. Not so simply, maybe. How to live for your life, your family, your career, and to stay out of jail. With innovation guru Clayton Christensen. He's advised all kinds of companies, students, friends, fellow Mormons. That's in the book as well. Now he's ready to advise you. Clay, you join us today from Salt Lake City. Talk about Church of Latter-day Saints country. You're in it right now. It's also your hometown. And you talk a fair amount about your faith as you provide this book. I mean, is that really the fundament here? Or do you have to sort of come to it from a faith perspective? Or is this notion of a kind of a get a plan in place and stick with it available to everybody?
Great question, Tom. For me, I really have come at it from a faith perspective, and it's been quite straightforward to me to really figure out what is the purpose of my life coming from that lens. But if you don't come from that lens, you'll get in the same place. So people like I believe that God will judge our lives. But people who don't believe that there's a God, still, if they think about it, their life will be measured just as well. And the people who will measure their life are people who have known them. And there are a lot of people who live lives, and when they come to the end, the people who have known them are quite happy not to think of them again. And they very quickly evaporate in people's memories. And other people will live lives where when they come to the end of their life, people will remember them for the things that they have done long after their mortal life is finished. And so in the end, we all will be judged. The question is, who will judge us? But I bet that the kind of person you want to become, so that our life will be judged in ways that we feel satisfied with, are similar whether you come at it from a religious perspective or not.
The heart of what I'm reading here, Clay, seems to be articulating things up front, so that as you get buffeted around and find out just how vulnerable and frail we are as human beings, you've got some kind of set of targets or goals to hew to. Is that the path?
That's right. Life happens to us. And for example, I wanted to be the editor of the Wall Street Journal. All the time I was in high school and college, that was what I was targeting. And I tried three different times to get a job at the Wall Street Journal to become their ultimate editor.
They
didn't offer me a job.
Yeah, the cheek.
And so I started a company, and then I got fired from the company and became a doctoral student at age 40. And so now I'm a professor at Harvard, and it's been a good life. But it's not what I planned to do. Almost all of us find that professionally, what we end up doing isn't what we intend to do. And that's just fine. That's the way the world works. But I just decided that it makes no sense at all to allow what the kind of person you become to be left to a game of chance. And what we assert in the book is that we can figure out, as we look into our future, what's the kind of person I want to become? And in my case, I want to become the type of person that God wants me to become. And that can be a beacon so that it doesn't matter what else happens in my life, that serendipity happens professionally and in health and so on. I can mold those things so that it contributes my desire to become the kind of person I want to become. That can be deliberate. It doesn't need to be left to chance.
It can come from, I guess, scripture in your case, or if that's not what people are building on, what you're saying, lay down some kind of aspirational, clear understanding early on so that you don't get blown off course later.
That's right. And the metric the framing in my mind is, I know I will be judged. Every one of us will be judged. And when I am judged, this is the kind of person I want them to find.
Let's go to our listeners. Clay Christensen is with us, and his new book is How Will You Measure Your Life? He has advised an awful lot of big and small companies over the years. Now he's turning to individuals. Chicago, David's calling from Chicago. David, you're on the air with Clay Christensen.
Hello. That is a great lead-in to what my question is going to be about. We live in a time that's like the Industrial Revolution. People are changing their skills and learning new skills, yet other people's perceptions of people are locked in, you know, the perceptions that they grew up with. And I'm curious what Clayton saw in his research about people's hardships, about these issues of how other people perceive us, and sometimes those perceptions don't change with the changing times that we live in.
You mean we've got economic turbulence, so we may not end up where you may not end up where you intend. David, is that it?
Yeah, well, even more than that, the psychological aspects, the same things that prevent companies from changing in the way that he's advocated in his previous books, mm-hmm. prevent people and individuals from perceiving people with new and different skill sets and mindsets. In ways that sometimes they don't appreciate the new skills or the new ways of thinking about the world that progressive individuals such as Clayton and others do.
Clay, what about all this in particularly turbulent economic times and the way we see those times and are perceived in those times?
Boy, great point, David. This is how I've come to think about it. Because you and I have limited, finite minds, in order to have a sense of what's going on, even what's going on in your life, it's really hard. And as a consequence, we have to aggregate up in order to get a sense for what's going on. So if I were a CEO, I couldn't remember all the details of individual sales. We have to aggregate that up as a number we call revenues, and I can't keep track of all of the little elements of cost. I have to aggregate that into a number that we call cost, and then we take one away from the other to get profit. And we have to aggregate things because our minds are so finite. And as we aggregate, we get a sense that people who preside over bigger numbers have more power, and their lives are bigger than people who preside over little numbers. And so we get this sense of hierarchy. And I think most of us think of the world in those kinds of terms, but the difference is that God doesn't have to hire accountants. What I mean by that is because he has an infinite mind, God doesn't have to aggregate up above the level of the individual to have a perfect understanding of what's going on in the world. And that means that when I will come to the end of my life and have my interview with God, He's not going to ask how many people I presided over, or what big numbers I had, or you're a professor at the Harvard Business School versus you're doing something else. Those situations won't ever come up in the conversation, but rather He's just going to say, okay, Clay, I stuck you in this situation. Now, let's talk about the individual people whose lives you helped to become better people by the blessings and talents that I gave to you. And then, Clay, I stuck you in that situation. Let's talk about the individual people whose lives you helped to become better people. And so the measure by which God will measure my life isn't in numbers, but individual people whose lives I helped to be better. And so what that means, I think, David, that you could think about, is it isn't so much what other people think of you with your new skills, given how turbulent our economy is, but rather if you think about who are the people whose lives I helped to become better, that's the way God will measure your life. And then what you'll find is that what people think of you is the result of what you have done to try to help them.
Clay, is this notion of a life's end interview with God, is this a particularly Mormon notion? Are you suggesting you see it in all religions? And I guess I come back again to people who just don't frame up their life in God terms.
Yeah. Well, for me, it is very helpful to think of myself having an interview at the end. I have a few questions I want to ask Him, and I imagine He's going to have a lot more questions about me. But I don't think that it applies, that this is not a useful way to think about life for anybody. One reason I chose my co-authors, James Allworth and Karen Dillon, is James Allworth is a former student of mine. He's an avowed atheist. And I wanted to be sure that in the book, we sing to both ends of the spectrum there. And he views it just in the way I've described, that even though he doesn't believe there's a God, his life truly will be judged by people who interacted with him. And the only question is, in what way will they remember him? And it will be in the same metric, and that is the individual people whose lives he helped. If we think about our life in terms that are above that, aggregated above that, groups of people don't hold opinions about individuals. Individuals their lives are affected by individuals. And that's the way you need to measure your life.
David in Chicago, I appreciate your call. Let's get one right here from Hanover, New Hampshire. Ryan is calling. Hi, Ryan. You're on the air with Clay Christensen.
Hi. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I have a sort of a application question. I wonder, let's assume that your guest is correct in the approach. I'm wondering, how does one go about deciding, let's say, to walk away from, say, one achievement-based element of your life, a career, for example, that you don't find very fulfilling in the long term? So in the short term, you know, you make money and you have successes and so on. In favor of something like raising a child, for example, how does one, can you give some advice, I guess, on how to muster the courage or the wherewithal to walk away from a career if it's what you actually do want to do without feeling like you've just quit or, you know, given up, become a quitter to become a stay-at-home parent, for example?
Clay, how do you follow this advice without coming off or feeling like a quitter?
Again, a great question. My other co-author, Karen Dillon, was the executive editor of the Harvard Business Review, and she edited the article that I wrote before we wrote this book, and she decided that she needed to quit. And the reason is that she, when she added up how she was living her life on a day-to-day basis, it didn't sum up to the life that she wanted to live. And so she quit and realized that her children meant a lot more to them than was being evidenced by how she spent her time. And you should talk to her. She's just happy in ways that she never imagined before. And so that's what you have to decide. If this is the kind of person I want to become, and this is the one of the relationships with my family and that I want to have, if I'm not investing to do that, then what is life for? Because your strategy isn't what you say it's going to be, but rather your strategy is what you're spending your time in on a day-to-day basis. And what I found is that the world is really quite accommodating to our efforts to invest in a life that we want to have. For example, when I first got out of school, I worked for a big consulting firm in Boston where you spent 70 to 90 hours every week. And I'd been there about a month, and my project manager came to me and he said, "Clay, we got a meeting Sunday at 2 p.m. Because we have a big meeting with the client the mm-hmm. next day." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Mike, oh my gosh, I can't come on Sunday because I committed to God that's my Sabbath." And he was just so mad at me. But they walked away, and he came back, and he said, "Look, I talked to the team. We'll meet Saturday at 2 p.m. And I said, "Oh, my gosh, Mike, I'm sorry, but I committed to my wife that I wouldn't work on Saturday. That's the day for my family." And Mike was even madder at me. And then he walked away, and he came back, and he said, "Clay, do you happen to work on Friday?" And it turned out that never again in the 5 years that I was working with the firm did anybody ever ask me to work on Saturday or Sunday.
But Clay, not everybody is a Rhodes Scholar. I mean, a lot of people in this country, women especially, can't even get flex time, let alone tell their boss, "Oh, I can't do this, I can't do that." You know?
Yeah.
Is that really, you know, is it really that accommodating? That's not my observation.
I think everybody thinks their situation is unique and difficult. I think my experience, of course, my own might be different. It might be harder. Who knows? But I certainly have spent a lot of time with a lot of people. And I think that a lot of times what we say we cannot do actually is something that we can do. We just have to tell people that this is not the reason that I'm living my life. This is my purpose. And if I can't be that kind of a person working in this company, I don't want to be here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how to live for your life, your family, your career, and to stay out of jail with innovation guru Clayton Christensen. He's advised all kinds of companies, students, friends, fellow Mormons. Now he's ready to advise you in a new book. It's called How Will You Measure Your Life? Co-authored with James Allworth and Karen Dillon. He joins us today from Salt Lake City. Clay, it's clear not everybody, everybody sees, I mean, everybody. I'm looking at all the comments coming in and people say, "Well, this is admirable, but how do you pull it all off? You know, put together making a living and supporting a family." Here's one listener talk. You know, said people got lost after a promising start. Listener writes, "Getting lost after a promising start? That's the story of my life. I had such promise. Now every year my ambition wanes, and I now delight in being a mediocre worker who listens to On Point while on the job. And you know what? I'm happy." This listener writes, "if dissatisfied." Does it really all fit together for everybody, or do you have to be a, I don't know, Harvard Biz School whiz who, you know, even when they make compromises, things still work out fine?
Boy, again, great question. I think it'd be interesting to ask Tom to measure your life, you know, and are you in a situation where you don't have these same choices? I bet you the answer is that you have very similar choices and that almost all of us are right at the edge of what we want to do. And the answer, again, is if professionally life hasn't turned out the way you had hoped it would be, mm-hmm. that actually doesn't matter. What really matters is in the space of all of that adversity and unpredictability, are you becoming the kind of person you want to become? And are you, as you pursue your profession, are you trying to help other people to become better people? And you can achieve on those dimensions independently of whether the professional pursuit that you initially envisioned actually has materialized in your life. That's what's not important, is the kind of profession that you end up in. I've had through three so far. But the kind of person you become is something that you do not need to live to chance.
And yet you've ended up in a profession where you're clearly very much at home. It's satisfactions. We read here and we can see it's obvious. They're very deep to you. How much of that is serendipity that you end up there, and how much is planning?
Well, working hard, you find yourself in situations where good luck happens to people who work hard, and there's no argument against that. But I think that's just the way to think about your life is that the kind of person you become doesn't have to be left to chance, and your profession can be left to chance, because for all of us, it's just a rare person that becomes professionally the person that they intended to be.
So much happenstance in life. Rebecca in Andover, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Clay Christensen.
Hi, Tom and Clay. I called in because I'm concerned about Clayton's focus on judgment being the reason we live our lives. He seemed in the beginning of the hour to say a lot about what other people might think about our lives once we've passed, or what God would think about our lives when we meet him.
Or her.
Yes. I'm concerned if we make choices and plans based on other people's judgments or even God's judgments, then we risk losing ourselves and losing our own satisfaction or happiness in life, especially when it comes to focusing on what other people might think of us. I come from the Mormon faith and find that often people are concerned with how they appear to others and what others think of them, and it can be very troubling because you're focused so much on what you appear like instead of what your own drive or initiative might be, or how you find happiness for yourself.
Yeah, I'm grateful you raised this, because I think I might have mischaracterized what I really wanted to say, and that is we each individually need to decide what kind of person that we want to become. And to get to that point, I don't think that it's inconsistent for me to say, what are the characteristics of Clay Christensen do I want to find myself having accumulated or built over the course of my life that will cause other people to say, he was an honest man. He was a selfless man. He gave whatever he had to help other people to be better people. And that's not what other people want me to look like. I want to figure out what kind of person I want to be. And having those characteristics or those adjectives about Clay Christensen is the kind of person I want to become. I don't think it's unwise to think about what kind of impact I have on other people, because in fact, that's the way God will measure my life.
Clay, let me ask you while we've got you. It's a rare opportunity for us, and it comes, our visit today comes at a really interesting moment. We have a presidential campaign shaping up. You've got Barack Obama as the incumbent. You've got Mitt Romney as the challenger. Apparently, will be the nominee of the Republican Party. Mitt Romney is somebody I think you've shared church experience with, temple experience, and maybe gone to the same temple. You've both been bishops in the Mormon faith, Church of the Latter-day Saints. You've even written about what that religious background might mean, I think, for a Romney presidency, if that's where we go. Help us with that while we've got you. What do you see in Mormon teaching that we might expect to see reflected in the way Mitt Romney would handle, speaking of impact, the top leadership position in this country? What kind of teaching might inform that, or worldview might inform that?
Well, boy, great question again, Tom. I hope that what Mitt would bring to the presidency, if in fact he is elected, that he might bring from his Mormon faith, is a proclivity to ask questions. Because you can never get good answers if you don't ask the right questions. And I think one of the central beliefs in the way we live our lives is just to be sure that we're asking the right questions about what the purpose of life is. And we teach that at the Harvard Business School. The whole purpose of the case method is to help our students figure out what are the right questions that we need to ask in order to get the right answer. And I worry that so much of Washington is filled with people who have decided that they know the answers and they're not asking the right question.
What about Governor Romney himself? There was a big article you were quoted in the New York Times over the weekend about his religious faith. One of the things that was pointed out there were people who know him well saying that he's very rule-oriented, particularly when it comes to application of Mormon teaching. How does that mesh with being, you know, question-oriented?
I disagree with people who believe that he is answer-oriented. I think he gets to his answers by asking good questions. And I certainly hope that he will continue that.
Is there a different outlook when it comes to optimism or America's role that Church of the Latter-day Saints may have given Mitt Romney from other candidates?
Well, I'll give you a slightly longer answer than you would hope to this one, Tom. Mm. There was a guy who came to Boston on a Fulbright scholarship. He was a Marxist economist from China. And he came to study democracy of all the crazy ideas. We got to know him quite well. And when he was done over with his year, we asked him, did you learn anything about democracy that you never thought about before? And he articulated a very interesting model. And he said, yeah. So a society can be prosperous and peaceful under two conditions. One is there have to be clear rules, and two, there has to be a mechanism for holding people accountable if they don't follow the rules. And he said, so there are two ways to get that. One is you could be Singapore. They have very clear rules, and if you don't follow the rules, they have very effective mechanisms for punishing you. And they've created a magnificent society that is very peaceful and very prosperous because they have clear rules and they have mechanisms for holding people accountable. And he points out that the other way to do it is to have a democracy. But he said it is a much more difficult challenge than Singapore had, because by its very nature, the democracy is designed not to be able to catch people when they don't follow the rules. But it works because most people, most of the time in America, voluntarily choose to obey even unenforceable rules. And my Marxist economist friend said, the reason why people most of the time voluntarily to obey the rules is they believe that even if the government can't hold you accountable, there is a higher being who will hold you accountable. And he said, if you don't believe that there is a mechanism to hold people accountable, either from the government or from another source, then democracy doesn't work. As a consequence, I don't think we should be at all afraid of having somebody who believes that people will be held accountable for doing the right things.
From Mitt Romney to a Marxist economist from China to Clay Christensen, his new book is How Will You Measure Your Life? Clay Christensen, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're kind to let me come, Tom.
In a moment, novelist Neil Gaiman's advice to the 2012 graduates of the University of the Arts. This is On Point. Award-winning author Neil Gaiman didn't attend university himself, but the fantasy and young adult writer, creator of The Sandman and Coraline, gave some very good advice last week to the graduating class of Philadelphia's University of the Arts. He talked about his own path in the arts and the problems that come with failure and success.
Sometimes the way to do what you hope to do will be clear-cut. And sometimes it'll be almost impossible to decide whether or not you're doing the correct thing, because you'll have to balance your goals and hopes with feeding yourself, paying debts, finding work, settling for what you can get. Something that worked for me was imagining that where I wanted to be, which was an author, primarily of fiction, making good books, making good comics, making good drama, and supporting myself through my words. Imagining that was a mountain, a distant mountain, my goal. And I knew that as long as I kept walking towards the mountain, I'd be all right. And when I truly was not sure what to do, I could stop and think about whether it was taking me towards or away from the mountain. I said no to editorial jobs on magazines, proper jobs that would have paid proper money, because I knew that, attractive though they were, for me, they would have been walking away from the mountain. And if those job offers had come earlier, I might have taken them, because they still would have been closer to the mountain than I was at that time. I learned to write by writing. I tended to do anything as long as it felt like an adventure, and to stop when it felt like work, which meant that life did not feel like work. When you start out, you have to deal with the problems of failure. You need to be thick-skinned to learn that not every project will survive. A freelance life, a life in the arts, is sometimes like putting messages in bottles on a desert island and hoping that someone will find one of your bottles and open it and read it and put something in a bottle that will wash its way back to you. Appreciation or a commission or money or love. And you have to accept that you may put out hundreds of things for every bottle that winds up coming back. The problems of failure are problems of discouragement, of hopelessness, of hunger. You want everything to happen and you want it now, and things go wrong. The problems of failure are hard. The problems of success can be harder because nobody warns you about them. The first problem of any kind of even limited success is the unshakable conviction that you're getting away with something and that any moment now they will discover you. It's imposter syndrome, something my wife Amanda christened the fraud police. In my case, I was convinced there would be a knock on the door and a man with a clipboard. I don't know why he had a clipboard, but in my head, he always had a clipboard, would be there to tell me it was all over and they'd caught up with me, and now I would have to go and get a real job, one that didn't consist of making things up and writing them down and reading books I wanted to read, and then I would go away quietly and get the kind of job where I would have to get up early in the morning and wear a tie and not make things up anymore. the problems of success. They're real. And with luck, you'll experience them. The point where you stop saying yes to everything because now the bottles you threw in the ocean are all coming back. And you have to learn to say no. I watched my peers and my friends and the ones who were older than me, and I'd watch how miserable some of them were. I'd listen to them telling me they couldn't envisage a world where they did what they've always wanted to do anymore, because now they had to earn a certain amount every month just to keep where they were. They couldn't go and do the things that mattered and that they'd really wanted to do, and that seemed as big a tragedy as any problem of failure.
That was fantasy and young adult writer Neil Gaiman addressing the class of 2012 at Philadelphia's University of the Arts. To watch a video of his address and for a full transcript, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.